This is Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition. Visit traditiononline.org to sign up for our regular email updates, follow us on social media, or subscribe or give a gift subscription to someone you know who really ought to be counted among the ranks of Tradition's readers. Give us a like or 5 stars on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on, and help others discover the array of media, digital, audio, social, which orbit our center of gravity, the Quarterly Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought, published by the Rabbinical Council of America since 1958. If one by one we counted people out for the least sin, it wouldn't take us long to get so we had no one left to live with. For to be social is to be forgiving. So wrote the poet Robert Frost. But there it is, after all. What is the purpose of forgiveness? How necessary is it to maintain working social order within the larger body politic or within a smaller religious community? Is forgiveness the work of the offender to seek it, or the offended to willfully grant it? These are topics we think about from time to time, usually with the seasonal arrival of the month of Elul, but there are profound philosophical and halachic issues which circle this topic. In a truly remarkable new essay appearing in Tradition's Fall 2024 issue, Nettie Penstein explores the interplay of halachic sources in the writings of Maimonides, Rabbi Soloveitchik, and others, and brings that wisdom to bear in puzzling out and offering a solution to a particular 50-year-old philosophical paradox, reminding us of the Rav's dictum, "Out of the sources of halacha, a new worldview awaits formulation," which collapses the barrier between halachic sources in writing and philosophical insights. Nettie Penstein is a graduate of Princeton University, where she studied philosophy, and is currently completing an MA in Jewish philosophy at Yeshiva University's Bernard Revel Graduate School and at its graduate program in Advanced Talmud Studies. As you'll hear from the enthusiasm in my voice during our conversation about her work, Nettie gives us all optimism about the next generation of educators, thinkers, and writers in our community, and we look forward to more of her work in the pages of Tradition. Welcome to the Tradition podcast, Nettie Penstein.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Readers of Tradition have been marveling at your recent essay, Forgiveness, a Philosophical Analysis of the Halachic Sources. It really is a quite remarkable paper, and I think it will prove to be an important contribution to the world of Jewish thought and Jewish philosophy. The fact that it was written by someone so talented, yet frankly, so young, maybe we'll talk about that later in our conversation, but it's all the more reason why we should be paying attention to it when a young voice comes with such an original contribution to our religious life and learning. And it's framed around Kolnai's paradox, a philosophical problem having to do with forgiveness as a thought problem. So Nettie, first of all, explain to us who Kolnai was and what this paradox is.
Sure. So Kolnai, or Oral Kolnai, is his full name. He was actually a Jewish philosopher, although he didn't really dabble in the realm of Jewish philosophy. He was more of a secular philosophy. He's actually a bit of an eclectic philosopher. He had a lot of pieces about political philosophy, but also moral philosophy. And he wrote a paper towards the end of his life entitled Forgiveness, where he basically presented a paradox of forgiveness. So we all have the intuition that forgiveness is something that is sometimes a virtue, but not always a virtue. And so what Kolnai tried to do is figure out in what circumstances would we say that it's a virtuous thing to forgive someone. And so he started off imagining a situation in which the perpetrator is completely unrepentant. They, you know, made you feel terrible, they teased you, they did something wrong to you, and yet they have no feelings of remorse. They don't express any sense in which they feel bad for what they've done. And he says, in that case, it seems pretty obvious that forgiveness is not only unwarranted, but it would actually probably be a morally problematic thing to do, right? If I just forgive that person, I'm either deceiving myself into pretending that what they did didn't hurt me, or in a way, I'm condoning the wrongdoing that they did. And he refers to that type of forgiveness as condonation, to just accept someone's something morally wrong without any kind of protest. So he says in that case, it's clear that forgiveness is not only not virtuous, but would actually be a problematic response. But then he looks at the reverse case, right? Imagine this person does feel very guilty and remorseful for what they have done. And they apologize to you and they want to be different. They realize that what they did was wrong. And he says that in that case, it doesn't seem like there's any special virtue of forgiveness left for you to have. In that case, they've, reformed themselves. They've kind of, the way that he uses this expression of they're kind of joining onto your team, so to speak. You agree with the perpetrator that what they did was a problem and that it's something that they shouldn't do in the future. And in that case, he says, what's really at play is kind of a basic moral principle of treat someone in accordance with their moral value. And now that this person has reformed themselves and, agrees with you that what they did is wrong, they deserve to be treated as a morally upstanding individual. And so in that case, he says forgiveness has kind of lost its reason for existing. It doesn't seem like a virtue, it just seems like a basic moral obligation. And so he kind of presents this as a paradox where either forgiveness seems to be unwarranted, as in the case where the perpetrator doesn't repent, or unnecessary, as in the case where the perpetrator does repent.
So now we've been using, you've been using terms here like the perpetrator and forgiveness and repentance, et cetera. The listener can be forgiven for translating some of these terms into halachic terminology, tshuva and mechila and kapara and et cetera. And we're gonna come to that, but it's important to note that he presents this as an issue in moral philosophy, independent of religious virtues and ethics. This paper is published in 1973 at the end of his life. It's published in the Proceedings of the Aristotelian Society, which no doubt people have laying around on the coffee table, or maybe the Google machine can dredge it up if they're looking to read the original. But you've done that work for us by reading Kolnai in the original. But for 50 years now, 50 years plus, Kolnai's paradox has been sitting around without any real satisfactory answer. A few people have made attempts. Why is that? Why is this such a hard philosophical nut to crack?
Yeah, so it's exactly as you said, there's definitely been attempts to solve the paradox. I think that many of them are not so satisfactory. I think it's very interesting because I think this is something that I've always loved about philosophy, which is that it takes these everyday phenomena that we really take for granted and it puts them under a microscope in a way that all of a sudden makes something that seems so familiar really strange. And I think that's exactly what Kolnai is doing, where he kind of shows us that this concept of forgiveness, which we really take for granted, and we take it for granted that it is a virtue, is actually something that is really difficult to pin down. And part of why I think the nut, as you said, is so difficult to crack is because even if it's true that in certain cases forgiveness is a basic obligation and really just a response to the perpetrator's, teshuva, as you said, or his reformation, it's psychologically can still be challenging. It's, when we resent someone and we feel like we've been hurt, it's sometimes hard to let go of that, even if at an intellectual and moral plane, it's the necessary and obvious response. So I think that that might be underlying this sort of like stickiness of the paradox and the difficulty to really respond to it.
A little bit, it's dependent on which end of the telescope we look through. Is forgiveness something that the perpetrator needs to seek out, or is forgiveness something that the wronged party has to grant? And depending upon which perspective you come to, you might be led in different directions. But you come to this problem, and being a young Talmidat Chachamim, your mind immediately goes to the Rambam, to certain passages in Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings, and you say the halachic tradition, our tradition, might provide a response to this half-century puzzle that's been out there in the world of moral philosophy. So lead us through a bit that sourcing and how you present your argument and what it is you say there while standing on the shoulders of those giants.
So it's interesting because the Rambam's discussion of forgiveness really presents its own puzzle. And I think that the two puzzles kind of answer each other in a way, because the Rambam in Hilchos Teshuva, when he presents the obligation both to ask for forgiveness but also to forgive, he does so in a way that seems rather extreme. He starts off with he describes it in the negative of lo yehei adam achzari milim kol, that you shouldn't be cruel and not forgive. And the word achzari, which means cruel, has a lot of weight in the Rambam. He really only uses it in a very limited context and for things that really do strike us as cruel. And yet, when he actually describes what's entailed by not being cruel, it seems like a very, very high standard, right? He says that to not be cruel is to forgive immediately the moment that the perpetrator asks for forgiveness, and with, fully and completely wholeheartedly. And what I actually did was looked at because the Rambam seems to be quoting a Mishnah and a Medrash, and I tried to look back at the sources that the Rambam was drawing from. And when you look back at the sources, what you discover is the Rambam takes what's most extreme from each of the sources and combines them to get this extreme formulation. So there's a Medrash that's actually based on the story of Avraham asking God for forgiveness for Avimelech, where the Medrash says that in order to be Rach kekana, to be as soft as a reed, so someone who's, very easygoing and quick to forgive, someone should forgive immediately and wholeheartedly the moment that the perpetrator asks for it. So those are kind of the guidelines that the Rambam has. But that Medrash phrases it as a positive. In order to cultivate and aspire to this positive attribute, this is what we should do. And in that context, I can appreciate the high standard because, I imagine that everyone is working towards being someone who's as soft as a reed and is easygoing, and that's something that we can spend our lifetime striving for. Whereas if you look at where the Rambam gets the line about not being cruel, that comes from a Mishnah in Bava Kamma, and there the Mishnah says, right, a person shouldn't be cruel and not forgive. When the perpetrator asks for forgiveness, that person should forgive. But there, the Mishnah makes no mention of doing so immediately or wholeheartedly. And it seems as though what the Mishnah is saying is that if you spend your entire life never forgiving someone who asks for your forgiveness, that's when you're considered cruel. But it doesn't say, you're considered cruel if you don't forgive immediately. And there too, I can understand someone who holds a grudge their whole lifetime, that indeed does seem to be a measure of cruelty. But the Rambam combines the two. So he starts off with the idea of cruelty, but he says that in order to not be cruel, you have to, do all the things that the Medrash describes, which is to be, soft and quick to forgive and do so immediately and wholeheartedly. And so I thought of that as a real puzzle because the Rambam seems to be placing, a really, really high bar. And rather than phrasing it in terms of an aspiration towards a positive attribute, he really phrases it as avoidance of a terrible attribute.
Right. So, and if, it is curious because there are, as you pointed out, the paradox exists in the Rambam, as well. Now, so much of Hilchot Teshuvah is very much sinner focused, is very much oriented towards the wrongdoer and how the wrongdoer can both make up for his deeds, misdeeds, but also how such a person reforms their own personality. And the description of the Baal Tshuva as somebody who can say, Ani acher ve'eini oto ha'isha asa otam ha'masim. I'm somebody else. How does it work? The paradox of Tshuva. An essay which our friend Rabbi Yitzchak Blau once wrote a very profound the topic that our friend Rabbi Yitzchak Blau once wrote a very profound essay in the pages of tradition years ago when we were young, when he was about your age. You're in good company. The idea that the transformative power of tshuva, that having done tshuva, I'm no longer that person that committed those sins. So therefore, obviously, I can't be punished because the person who did the sin no longer exists. He's been completely metamorphosized into a new creature. But then when it comes to the discussion of mechila, the Rambam really does cast it. I mean, he does mention that you have to go and you have to try to appease the person you wronged. If you have gezel in your hand, you have to return any stolen objects, certainly. But then the Rambam really does put the work at the foot of the wronged party. The wronged party also. So both sides of Kolnai have antecedents already in the rabbinic literature and then as codified by the Rambam. David Schatz, Professor David Schatz, who's a very valued member of the tradition family and you know, who was helpful in working with you and bringing this paper forward to publication, pointed out to me that this is a real classic, good old-fashioned Torah Umada paper. And had the Torah Umada journal still been in business and had he still been the editor, he probably would have tried to steal it away to publish it there. But I'm glad that it appeared in tradition. But it really is. In other words, that taking this, I mean, it happens again that Kolnai happened to be Jewish, but the paper in no way situates itself in Jewish discourse. To the best of my knowledge, none of his work did. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. But then to try to bring to bear the lens of our sources, of our tradition, of our philosophical traditions to answer that really is so I'm curious about, you know, how you came to this. We should let our listeners know you studied philosophy at Princeton, and having completed your studies there, you made the transition to Midtown Manhattan, where you've been studying in the GPATS program, the graduate program for advanced Talmud at Stern College, and this year you've begun some adjunct teaching at Stern College, and you plan on going on for a PhD in Jewish philosophy. And like I said, we're looking forward to great things. But now, how does that mind work? How do you come to think about this problem? First of all, how were you first exposed to Kolnai's paradox, and then, you know, lead us through the machinations in that brain of yours that came to the solution.
Yeah, sure. So to start with how I was introduced to the paradox, 2 years ago, my first year in GPATS, I was part of a fellowship run by the Sachs Herrenstein Center. It was a graduate fellowship in ethics and entrepreneurship. And each of the fellows had to do some kind of project inspired by Rabbi Sachs's legacy. So I thought I had heard from some friends of mine who had gone to Stern, as well as my sister, who was a student there, that people felt like there was, lacking in the intellectual discourse, and that it would be nice to have some kind of club or, organization that was focused on cultivating that outside of the classroom. And so I came up with this idea of having these monthly seminars that I ran, choosing a topic in moral philosophy to discuss from both a secular philosophical perspective and a Jewish philosophical perspective. And I allowed the students to pick the topics, which was a mistake because they could, pick something that I didn't necess hadn't necessarily researched. And so one of the topics that people chose was forgiveness. And I looked around, and a lot of the topics that I had done in the past, I was able to find, like an Orthodox forum devoted to that entire topic, or lots of tradition articles devoted to that topic. And so I was more in the position of cultivating and presenting the material for the students to discuss. But with this topic, I really struggled, actually, both from a secular philosophy perspective and a Jewish philosophy perspective, to find the material. So I was in Revel at the time, and I was exposed to Dr. Daniel Reinhold there. So I asked him if he knew of any like secular philosophy works on forgiveness.
And he
So he
pointed to
pointed.
Coleman.
Yeah, so he pointed me to it was called it's actually a great it's a great book. It's called Forgiveness and Mercy. It's co-written by Gene Hampton and Jeffrey Murphy, and they have a back and forth. And that's where I first came
Yes,
across
you reference it in
Kolnai's
the paper.
paradox. Yes, exactly. So that was really what got me thinking about how interesting of a philosophical problem forgiveness could be. And then that also exposed me to Kolnai's paradox. And it was from doing the research for that session where, like I said, I had to do a lot more research than any of the other ones, that I started to think about this topic. And that was what eventually led to writing this paper. But in terms of the question of, coming to the combination, I guess, of philosophy and halachic discussion, I was always very drawn to philosophy. I couldn't tell you like exactly why, but I knew that that was what I wanted to study as an undergraduate. And I remember like I had a moment where I realized what it was about philosophy, which was I was in a seminar. They had seminars in your junior year with all the philosophy majors. And our professor told us that the reason that he loves philosophy is because it's an excuse to talk about anything that interests him from like a rigorous and meaningful perspective. And I realized that that's exactly what it was, that philosophy is not really a canon of thought, but it's more of a set of tools. And it gives you these tools to be able to take the things that are on your mind, whatever problem it is, and analyze it in a way that's rigorous, in a way that opens up the discussion further, and in a way that I think ultimately like uncovers a lot more meaning. So to me, it was sort of natural to take the tools that I had, and I guess to apply them to the things that were on my mind. And those were the different, halachic or Jewish thought kinds of topics that were on my mind.
One of my teachers once observed that if done properly, and that's a big assumption, but if done properly, there's nothing more practical than philosophy. That's philosophy, the word, the phrase philosophy is often understood by people in the street as being synonymous with esoteric, with non-practical, with theoretical, with no real payoff or dividend in this world. And I'm not only talking financial, although certainly financially, philosophy rarely pays off big dividends, which is probably why there are more business students than there are in the liberal arts these days, and certainly in philosophy departments. But if done properly, there's nothing more practical than philosophy. And here you've put your finger on this. This is a daily, anybody who lives in human society, anybody who's in a marriage, happy or troubled, understands that forgiveness is the daily bread of life. Right? That these are the things we bump up against too in the workplace, in the home, in the family, in the community. Right? We're constantly in need of forgiving. We're constantly in need of receiving forgiveness and of granting forgiveness. So it's practical on the day-to-day, but also as a sugya in the religious world, in our religious world. Well, we have a whole season dedicated to we have 40 days of the calendar marked off for let's try to get this right. Let's try to see if I can obtain the forgiveness that I'm in need of because of all my shortcomings, and let's see if I can live up to the same and grant it to others. So in that regard, it really is a very practical thing. So I'm curious, if you'd share with us from your own, personal experience, like how does delving into this question from the philosophical point of view, from the halachic point of view, how did it shape your recent experience of the Yamim Noraim? Was this something that was on your mind? Did you examine it differently? Did you approach those that wronged you, or that, well, you're such a nice person, it's hard to imagine you wronging anyone, but theoretically, let's say.
It's a great question. And I think, as you said, part of what's so important and attractive, I guess, about the topic of forgiveness is, like you said, it's really, day to day. Sometimes when you read the, let's say, even just the Rambam, and you hear the description of forgiveness, it could seem esoteric in a way, like it's this, description of this perpetrator approaches the victim. But I think you're right that it's actually just part of day to day life. And I always find that delving into something more carefully really does make me more aware of how it arises in day-to-day life. And something that I noticed that I think is interesting, like as I was working on this paper and then it became the Elul season as well, is that people don't always express their remorse in that like formula that we think of, right? I'm sorry that I did this, I won't do it again, or you won't call me for it. And yet they still really do express their remorse for it. And I was noticing that, in relationships where sometimes a friend does something and they don't necessarily, they might acknowledge it, but not in as much of a formal way. And I think I was more attuned to picking up on that and to realizing, they're different now. Like they realize that that wasn't the right way to handle that situation. They're acting differently now. And to me, it was a great moment actually, because I think it brought down even further the abstract into the practical. And I think that when part of what I tried to argue in the paper was that part of like where we can discover the virtue of forgiveness is just in being conscious about the judgments that we make of others. And in real life, sometimes we're not even aware that we're making a judgment of someone, but we are making that judgment. And so I think that that consciousness also filtered into just being conscious of when people are actually apologizing for things. And it doesn't always look like, that formula in the Rambam or even that example in that thought experiment in a philosophical paper, but it's a lot more prevalent than we realize.
We're recording this shortly after Thanksgiving, although our listeners will only be hearing it at some point in the future. And there was so much discussion about, oh my goodness, how are people going to manage, as if every American family, has some kind of strife in it around political differences. How are we going to manage to sit together over a can of cranberry sauce if we can't agree on who to vote for? And I think there's a lot to be said here for not just for religious virtues and religious obligations, but for civic life, how we manage to live together with people who aren't exactly like us, who we may feel have been on the wrong side of this issue or that issue. And I'm wondering, like, how we might translate some of the insights of what you've written here to, kind of larger audiences of how we come to live together with people that we feel are, if they haven't wronged me personally, then, I feel are enemies of the state or other kinds of critiques have been made against people we disagree with.
It's a great question. Something that I'm still thinking of, which is, I think, related to that question, is something that Kol Nai does is he says condonation is bad, right? To just pretend that someone did something wrong, pretend that when someone did something wrong to me, they didn't actually do something wrong to me. That's just, it's,
It's an important
deceiving ourselves.
I think the first time as I was reading the first draft, that phrase condonation, right? In other words, it's
Yeah.
not to be, it's the opposite of condemnation, right?
Exactly.
It's giving people,
Yeah.
letting people slide, letting every which is also not virtuous if taken to the extreme.
Exactly. So I think that something that Jean Hampton, who I mentioned, she co-wrote this book that introduced me to Kol Nai's paradox, something that she mentions, and if I recall correctly, doesn't even fully resolve herself, is condonation in a practical way, is it always bad? And she has, I think, an example of someone whose father-in-law is, I think that's the example, is very, very rude to them and is always making like snide comments. And
Yes,
the person
it's
might
always the annoying uncle at Thanksgiving who's blamed for such things. But since I'm both
Yeah,
an uncle and a
exactly.
father-in-law, I can relate.
Yeah, no, so this is not about father-in-laws in general. I think that was her particular example, but part of what she said was the daughter-in-law has to live with the father-in-law, and she might feel like there's her father-in-law can't change, he's not going to change, and in order to be sane and live with him, she has to kind of condone the behavior. And she sort of poses it as a question, is that bad? And I think that that's it really speaks to a question also about being with people that we really disagree with, and we feel that we have good moral reasons to disagree with their beliefs. And I think the question, I know I'm not answering, I'm just kind of reframing, but I think that the question really stands of, on the one hand, part of my reaction to, well, we can't change this person is, we should believe in human beings and their basic moral goodness. And to a certain degree, it's almost offensive to kind of totally give up on someone. On the other hand, it's practically true, and also perhaps like in having this temporary condonation, I think we often come to realize that we're not as different or as much at odds as we realize, and that sometimes there's more common ground that can only be achieved when you have this period, I guess, of condonation. And something that the Tor, when he introduces the obligation to forgive on Erev Yom Kippur, he says like the purpose of forgiveness on Erev Yom Kippur is so that like Lev Kol Yisrael is Shalem in Chaviro entering into Yom Kippur, that we're all kind of at one with each other going into Yom Kippur. And I think that it's interesting because the Torah is perhaps saying that even though during the rest of the year, maybe we have legitimate reasons to wait to forgive someone who hasn't yet apologized, there might be something about the Day of Atonement that we have to go into it with a united front, and that we have to really let anything go, even if we don't have reason to. And so I think that that might also be pointing to sometimes condonation is not so bad, and sometimes it can serve a higher purpose. And if we can direct it towards a higher purpose, then we can perhaps like circumvent what's morally problematic about it otherwise.
Yeah, as if there's like a third category, not just ben adam lechaverot, interpersonal, and ben adam lemako, between man and God, but ben adam la'amo, that in other words, I need to forgive you because you and I both have to get into this boat called Yom Kippur, and we need to plug up all the holes in the boat, and we need to move it forward together as one people. So I'm going to have to let slide what you may have done to me, and you'll forgive me for what I've done to you, because we need to all be in this boat together to get across to the Tikiat Shofar after Ne'ilah, as it were. I once heard from
Exactly.
Yuli Tamir, who at one point was the Minister of Education here in Israel. She had been a student of Isaiah Berlin, the great British Jewish philosopher. And she was once with him someplace, and this fellow comes up to Sir Isaiah and says all types of narishkeit, nonsense, things that she was sure, she'd seen Berlin, who could be pretty sharp, as some philosophers can, really could dissemble somebody for saying something so stupid. And Berlin smiled and nodded and shook the man's head and wished him well. And she said to him, "Sir Isaiah, what's gotten into you? I thought you were going to rip him limb from limb, metaphorically speaking, philosophically speaking." So he says, "Oh no, you see, this fellow is my father's first cousin. When it comes to relatives, everything's relative." So there's
That's a
something
great
to be said
line.
for that on one plane for the relationship of all the collective Jewish people. Towards the end of the
Yeah.
paper, you come to some of Rabbi Soloveitchik's teachings that are relevant to this, his what he writes about the Rambam and some of his other writings about forgiveness and tshuva and etc. And of course, we're mindful of his conclusion to the halachic mind, that out of the sources of halacha, a new worldview awaits formulation, that halachic material itself is the greatest source of hashkafic insight. Right, that philosophy emanates from law, and this complex relationship between law and philosophy, which was, of course, as far as the Rambam goes, was so deeply explored by the Rav's son-in-law, Professor Isidore Twersky, in his important work on the Rambam. This is a center. We kind of all we in the tradition orbit, in the orbit of Torah Umada, we kind of grew up with this as our bread and butter. That the halacha is itself a source of hashkafa, of machshava. But how did that play into your thinking? I know that this was an important point for you when you came to write this paper, and maybe in all of your work. So say a word about that.
So it's actually interesting. And as an undergraduate, you're required to do a senior thesis. And I wanted to write about halachic mind, mainly because I had seen that last sentence. I had read the part four and I was really blown away by it. It had a tremendous impact on me. And I was like, I want to understand how he gets here. So that was hard work. It's not the most accessible of the Rav's writings, but it definitely has a very close place in my heart. I spent, all year really just with that book, trying to figure out what the Rav is saying there. And I think that part of what I find so appealing about it, the Rav speaks about how if we want Jewish philosophy to be autonomous, to really be authentically Jewish and not influenced by other sources, it really needs to come from the sources of halacha. That is, the unique body of Jewish knowledge that we have. And I think that the idea of seeing halacha as this very technical and, nitty-gritty and practical realm that's very divorced from the big ideas of philosophy, it's really a mistake. And the Rav is definitely the person that shows you throughout all of his writings how much of a mistake it is. And he, more than anyone else, is able to build, the most beautiful philosophical tapestries from the most, as nitty-gritty or, halachic details. And I was very inspired by that. It also, I think, put things together for me in terms of my own interest. I had always felt drawn to both realms and to the type of analysis that exists when you're, reading a Gemara and putting together a halachic sugya, and the type of analysis that you're doing in philosophy. And to me, it always felt like there was a kinship there. And I think halachic mind, and especially that last sentence, and the Rav really as an example, put that into words and gave me sort of a clear model. And that's definitely what I strove to do in the paper. It's also something that I try when I'm teaching Gemara now. And my student actually recently joked to me that he's like, I wish this class was cross-listed with Jewish philosophy. And she was saying that like we end up discussing not by like through analyzing the Gemara, we really get to very fundamental questions of and the role of mitzvos in our lives that happens to be related to what we're learning in the Gemara class in general. But I think it's something that once you're exposed to it, it really kind of reframes both how you approach halacha in, recognizing and appreciating that it has these much bigger insights, and also in how you approach philosophy and realizing that Jewish philosophy isn't just its own realm, and I think, can often be exposed to the critiques of being influenced by other areas, but really is something that is, native to Judaism itself and to the halacha itself, and they really do go hand in hand.
Well, I mean, there's the rub, or there's the rav. I mean, how many people have read all the way through to the last line in Halachic Mind? How many of them were undergraduates when they did it? Not all that many. And this points to a larger problem, which is the state of philosophy. The state of machshava, the state of the liberal arts, something about which we clutch at our pearls at tradition all the time. We're wringing our hands over it all the time, but that doesn't, accomplish all that much, but give us some chapped hands. So, from your perch as, really, frankly, and forgive me for embarrassing you, really one of the hopeful lights of this regard for our community, how do you grade us? How are we doing as a religious community that always put these issues front and center as important values, as thinking religious beings, to be engaged with these ideas, to be trying to figure out where those sources of halacha come to give us a new worldview about important matters, right? Important matters in our lives, right? In our lives as individuals, as a religious community, as members of the larger body politic, as husbands and wives and fathers and mothers and spouses and siblings and co-workers, of how we rub up against each other and annoy each other and find a way out. How are we doing in general as a community at trying to really think deeply about these things and to educate towards a way to thinking about these things? How do you see it from your from the youth seats?
It's an interesting question. I think that in my experiences, I've been really fortunate, and I feel that I have been exposed to, I think, influences that have really encouraged me to pursue these kinds of questions and also been inspiring examples. I think that there is an extent into which I felt lonely at times in the pursuit. I think it's not something that I really ever felt like I was, surrounded by a community of like-minded people. And I think that that could definitely be challenging. It's people are, for very good reasons, a lot of times the focus is on what's perceived as more practical things. And I think to go back to what you said earlier about philosophy, it's almost like sometimes I wish I could just change that word, because I think it does come with this connotation of sitting in an armchair and just imagining things. And as you said, I think it can be and is extraordinarily practical, and it's almost as though that word kind of turns people away. I do think that I think the two things that I feel very optimistic about is, one, when I after I finished Halachic Mind, one of the things that I started to notice was that even though the people that are doing this have probably not read Halachic Mind and don't necessarily know anything in the Rav's terminology about the phrase that the Rav uses for this is descriptive reconstruction. So I don't think that that's like a familiar term that people use. And yet I think that many people are actually doing this, that a lot of shiurim that you go to really do take halachos and try to come away with some kind of machshava that emanates from that halacha. And I think that that's something that's actually more prevalent than I had realized. And it's something that I think if we give language to it would help to foster it even more. I think when you identify and pinpoint like a more subconscious phenomenon, it actually helps to make people think about it more and to grow and increase that phenomenon. So that's one thing I actually have sitting in my files. Maybe I'll do something with it. I wrote like a shorter, like more, I guess, popular appealed kind of piece about this topic, because I think, people are more aware of Halachic Mind than they might realize. I also think within the Jewish philosophy world, there's been kind of a turn to this idea of like analytic Jewish philosophy, using the tools of analytic philosophy, which is just the idea of clear and concise concepts and definitions and careful logical arguments, and just applying that to any kind of topic within the realm of Jewish thought. And I think that it's really promising. It's something that I hope to have an opportunity to work with. It's something that Samuel Leibniz, he talks about this a lot, about doing this and starting this. Dr. Daniel Reinhold in Revel, who I mentioned, has definitely been, his work has been an inspiration to me also. So I think that definitely, I guess maybe demystifying philosophy is the best hope. I do think that there is a certain extent to which I've felt lonely, but I've also really felt encouraged and really privileged.
It's an interesting turn that we've seen in the recent generation. Classically speaking, Jewish philosophy was practiced according to the model of continental philosophy. And there has been this recent turn towards analytical philosophy, and you mentioned, a few of the figures that are the head of that. I would add Aaron Siegel and David Schatz himself, who we've mentioned. And this transition of mode and method, I think, does say a lot about what's happening of trends in philosophy. And well, maybe we'll have to have you back to give us a little seminar on the differences between analytical and continental philosophy and why it makes a difference. And we're certainly looking forward to seeing much more of your work in the community at large and in the pages of tradition. Even though, of course, you turn to the sources of halacha to find a new worldview, you open the paper with a charming anecdote by the Christian writer C.S. Lewis, who's, I mean, virtually C.S. Lewis is virtually an honorary modern Orthodox Jew since he's quoted amongst us so frequently. You mentioned that Lewis once compared forgiving someone to learning how to swim. Until you do it successfully, it appears to be utterly impossible. While we're wrestling with the resentment that we feel towards someone who wronged us, we can't possibly imagine feeling differently towards them. Lewis describes the experience of suddenly realizing that he had forgiven someone that he had been trying to forgive for over 30 years. His immediate feeling was, "But it's so easy. Why didn't I do it ages ago?" And then you add, "A fear of swimming cannot generally be overcome through reasoned deliberation. The only option is to jump in, keep your head above water, and start treading." So, in terms of the work in front of us to advance the cause of thinking in the lives of religious Jews, I think you've made an important contribution. And of course, it is something that is done through reasoned deliberation, but it can't be left there. And the fact that you have jumped in and kept your head above water and started treading, it makes me optimistic that you're out there, and we're going to be following your career with great interest. So, Nettie Penstein, we thank you. Your paper, "Forgiveness: A Philosophical Analysis of the Halachic Sources," appeared recently in Tradition and is open access at traditiononline.org. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you for the conversation, and thank you for all of your support.